This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending 5th of July 2013. Hello and welcome to the Winchester Talking Newspaper with extracts from the Hampshire Chronicle, dated the 4th of July 2013, which this week has been edited by Jean Carswell, Ken Clemenson and Barbara Chase. Our readers today are Margot Meredith.
Hello.
John Richards.
Hello.
And Peter Lydiard.
Hello.
And I'm your presenter, John Parker. This weekend in Winchester sees the Hat Fair. It starts today, Friday, and continues until Sunday. And also it's the beginning of the Winchester Festival. The opening concert is tonight in the Cathedral, and events continue for the whole of next week. If you'd like to find out more information about what's going on for the Hat Fair or for the Winchester Festival, you should phone the tourist office. The telephone number is 01962 840 500. That's 01962 840 500. Lighting up times. Today, Friday the 5th of July, the sun rose at 5 o'clock this morning and will set at 20 past 9 this evening. And Wednesday of next week, the Wednesday the 10th, the sun will arise at about 5 past 5 in the morning, and the sun will set again at about 20 past 9 in the evening. If you know someone who is sight impaired and would like to receive our recordings, or if you have any problems with your memory stick or your player, the person to contact is Lynn Parker on 01962 862 826. That's 01962 862 826. There's a laminated card with this information inside each wallet should you need it, but please leave the card inside the wallet when you return it. The main headlines this week are: a cultural and sporting landmark for the city, question mark, Bushfield Challenge airs in High Court, and spending review puts future of volunteer groups in doubt. So we'll start off with the story behind the first headline.
A cultural and sporting landmark for the city, query. A long-running ambition to build an English language museum in Winchester could find a home at a rebuilt River Park Leisure Centre, campaigners have suggested. As reported in the Chronicle last week, the City Council wants to demolish the Leisure Centre and replace it with a new complex on the same site. The move has been heavily criticised by people campaigning for better leisure facilities in the city, but volunteers leading the English project want to share the new building. They say it could make River Park a cultural and sporting landmark. Professor Bill Lucas, one of the trustees of the scheme, said, "It's a very good location and we are in discussion with the council. Option one for us would be for a world-class sports centre at Bar End, so we could use whatever space is left as an exciting cultural centre. But if River Park is rebuilt on site, there is no reason why we couldn't move in. I think a deal could be made. If we combine a major cultural centre and a world-class sports complex, I think it would be quite compelling for visitors." The project initially wanted to use Woolstaplers Hall, a Victorian red brick warehouse which is part of the Silver Hill development. But Professor Lucas, Professor of Learning at the Centre for Real World Learning at the University of Winchester, said plans fell through because of a lack of space. He said, "Under the current Silver Hill plan, the whole of the top floor is reserved as residence accommodation, which would only leave us two floors. it's not commercially viable for us to use that space. Professor Lucas said the centre would contain four major elements: an English language museum, a regionally focused exhibit, space for a touring exhibit, and community facilities, including meeting rooms and catering. He said the costs range from £3 million to £20 million, depending on size, technology, and whether it shares the centre. Council leader Keith Wood said, "Something like this would depend on whether the English project had the money to fund it. There are other sites in the city that might be more appropriate. If River Park is built, there will be off the beaten track for people in the city centre to get to. We will certainly look at the plans, but we are still at very early stages." Meanwhile, campaigners have slammed the plans to replace River Park Leisure Centre rather than build a new state-of-the-art complex at Bar End. Winchester Fit for the Future has been lobbying for more indoor sports courts and a 50-metre swimming pool, and gathered more than 3,300 signatures in a petition in favour of it. Emma Back of Fit for the Future said, "We are very concerned about the footprint at River Park and whether it's big enough. They will have to spend a lot of money to improve the access, and I would ask if it's more cost-effective to build at River Park, make these changes and build more parking than it is to build at Bar End." Council leader Keith Wood said the Bar End option was financially very risky, claiming it would cost between £25 and £30 million. Council officers are working on a detailed plan for River Park and what the centre would include, and it will report back in September.
Bushfield Challenge airs in High Court. Judge set to decide on village green status. A complex legal row over whether a former military camp near Winchester can be declared a village green has been given its first airing at London's High Court. Landowners, the church commissioners, are seeking a ruling preventing Hampshire County Council from considering an application by Barbara Guthrie to register it as a green, thwarting their development plans. The church commissioners, who want to develop part of the land but allow public access to the rest, claim Mrs. Guthrie failed to successfully bring her application within a strict time limit after it put up a fence in 2003 and ended a key period of public use of the site. The application was due to go to a public inquiry before a government inspector last November, but that is on hold pending the outcome of these proceedings. If successful, the church commissioners hope to end the matter without the need for the inquiry. The case centres on the provisions of the 2006 Commons Act, which changed the law on village greens, but put in place a 5-year grace period to allow applications to be made to register areas of land that had been closed to the public prior to the Act coming into force. In this case, the fence was erected in July 2003, and the parties agree that this brought to an end any period in which the public used the land, quote, as of right, unquote, effectively without permission, which is a key requirement for any successful application. Mrs. Guthrie submitted her application in June 2008, within the 5 years, but it contained several defects that were not corrected until July 2009, 6 years after the fence went up. The judge is being asked to decide whether her application was made when it was received by the council or when the defects were corrected. If it was the latter, as the church commissioners claim, this will put an end to her bid to protect the site. However, if the judge rules that it was the former and that the application can proceed, she will face a further battle before the planning inspector, as the church commissioners deny that the public used the land as of right for the necessary 20 years before the fence went up. The hearing was scheduled to last 2 days, after which the judge reserved his decision in order to give it in writing. Mrs. Guthrie was at the High Court for the hearing with her husband and other members of the Bushfield Down supporters group. Outside court, she said, "This is an area of extremely beautiful downland to the southwest of Winchester, with views out over the cathedral. It is extremely important recreational land and is a fabulous area with really lovely resources. It has been in public use for over 50 years. If we cannot get it registered as a village green, I fear that daily access will be severely restricted." She said that the site covers 68 acres and is used by local people for activities such as cycling, kite flying, walking and picnicking and tobogganing in the winter.
Spending Review puts future of volunteer group in doubt. WACA has a proven 25-year-old track record, Boss tells City Council. The future of Winchester's leading voluntary service could be under threat under a review of civic spending. Winchester City Council has launched a consultation into the provision of a new support service for the voluntary sector. The council is considering a commissioned service, which would threaten the viability of Winchester Area Community Action, WACA, according to a report. It is part of a plan to reduce spending in the voluntary sector, with more than £700,000 budgeted for this year. That includes £84,500 for WACA, which runs many services, including a volunteer centre, dial-a-ride for the elderly and disabled, and mental health befriending. The report sets out three options: the status quo, invest more funding, or commission a new support service to offset reductions in grants. On the latter, the report said, such a move would have implications for the viability of WACA, including the delivery of its commercial contracts and grant-aided projects. This would need to be explored as part of a responsible approach to introducing any such arrangements. Paul Williams, Chief Executive of WACA, said the service wanted to continue its work in Winchester. He said, "We understand the pressures councillors are under and want to work with them to support them. We are not against commissioning and consultation, but there are definitely ways of doing it that will achieve the outcomes and savings they want that do not unpick an organisation that has been running successfully for 25 years. Speaking to Cabinet last Wednesday, Mr. Williams added, "WACA has a proven track record of success in dealing with the major issues that confront Winchester going forward: an ageing population, getting young people into the workforce, and helping people keep mobile, active and engaged with society. The service supports 200 organisations, has 40 full and part-time employees, and has a turnover of over £1 million. Council leader Keith Wood said, "We really do need to make sure that what we are doing is the best use of the money we've got. This review will prove whether we've got it right so far or if we've got it wrong." On Monday, an overview and scrutiny meeting heard that the council is currently spending little on commissioning. Eloise Appleby, Assistant Director for Economy and Communities, said, "What we spend on commissioning is a very small amount relative to our total spending, but one of the things flagged up is that the voluntary service has not geared itself up to bid effectively for contracts. Community Action Hampshire has complimented us for what we offer, but they felt there was a lack of readiness in the voluntary sector to make the most of the opportunities."
That concludes the headline stories, and next we have the death announcements. Cresswell, Shirley Cresswell, on the 26th of June, aged 79. Cutler, Brian Henry Cutler, at home on the 28th of June, aged 77. Dormer, Jean Dormer, known as Bim, nay Brimacum, died on the 28th of June, aged 92. Farmer, Julie Farmer, née Cooper, at the Countess Mountbatten Hospice on the 21st of June, aged 47. Hobson, Alan Hobson, at home on the 30th of June, aged 72. Matthews, Daphne Elizabeth Matthews, on the 21st of June at Tegfield House Nursing Home, Winchester, aged 88. Rogers, Blanche Rogers, of Abbots Barton Nursing Home, Worthy Road, Winchester, on the 18th of June, aged 108. Tierney, Violet Gladys Tierney, on the 24th of June, aged 88, at Alton. She was formerly of Alsford. West, Jill Margaret West, on the 29th of June, aged 70, at Countess Mountbatten Hospice. Next, we have Christian comment.
And this week it is written by Terry E. Hemming. And he starts his comment with a question, and he ends with a question. When are we honest about who we are? Who has the right to know what? Both Julian Assange and Edward Snowden are sheltering from governments because they feel people have the right to know what governments do. On the other hand, some governments argue that they have a right to know what their citizens do, to safeguard law and order. Privacy is a rather modern idea, which has come following architectural changes, with smaller families living in larger houses. In our village, I've heard of little two-up and two-down cottages not only having families with 11 children, but taking in lodgers to help with the finances. There couldn't have been much privacy under those conditions. Our definition of privacy is still a strange idea for many cultures. I remember teaching a foreign student many years ago who explained that his father's family of 11 brothers kept one bank account for the entire family. Yet we all have a desire for confidentiality, so that even with modern media, we do not want the world to know everything about us. We wish to be in control of what is made known to others. Many organisations, not only commercial ones, hire people to put forward an image for the press, and when we look in the mirror in the morning, we are trying to do that for ourselves. The big question then is, when are we honest about who we are? Do we believe that our public image is what we are? For Christians, the only one who knows us truly is God. Samuel was told by God, "Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord does not see as mortals see. They look on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." The psalmist takes this up when he acknowledges, "O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from far away. Even before a word is on my tongue, O Lord, you know it completely." Rather than frightening the believer, it is a relief to know there is someone who knows them as they are and yet accepts them. We neither can nor should hide who we are from God. For some of us, that is why we value what some people call confession. It is a place where we can be utterly honest about who we are with all our failings and frustrations. We don't have to hide anything. Where is it that you can be utterly frank, or are you worried about what you will discover?
We now move on to the letters to the editor of the Hampshire Chronicle. If you yourself would like to send a letter to the Hampshire Chronicle, you can do so by either telephoning 01962 860 836, that's 01962 860 836, emailing news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk, that's news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk. 5upperbrookstreet.co.uk, or you can write to the editor at 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, SO23 8AL. That's 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, SO23 8AL. The first two letters are on the same topic, which is to do with wind farms.
And the first letter is from Marcus Stanton, who says, "Wind supply not up to the task. Sir, those who support the Bullington wind farm are often highly principled and no doubt sincere in their belief that all wind farms are good. To them it matters not how big it is, nor where it is sited. Jock MacDonald's letter, chronicled June the 27th, typifies this approach, but omits these practicalities. Onshore farms are cheaper than offshore, but the quality of electricity supply is worse, since there is more reliable wind offshore and more of it. The wind analysis tool used in the industry indicates Bullington Cross would be within the 5% worst wind farm sites in the UK. The subsidy does not cover the costs of intermittency on the system, which could be as much again as the subsidy. There is a body of evidence showing that the low frequency noise and vibration, which some do not hear or sense, causes sleep deprivation and illness up to 3 kilometres away. The noise one can hear is uniquely annoying due to a rhythmical thumping that cuts through background noise. We can agree that planning permission is only given when wind farms pass the test for birds, bats and aeroplanes. Bullington is deficient on all three counts. Mr. MacDonald's conclusion that the alternative is a future where carbon-loving, fracking-loving, unfettered capitalists and easy romantics have their way does not recognise there are alternatives to wind farms generally, and Bullington Cross specifically. We should not be repeating the mistakes of Germany, where they are having to build lignite power stations which create more pollution, because wind supply simply can't do the job. So writes Marcus Stanton, Norton Manor Farm, Sutton Scotney.
And Keith Story writes, "Wind farm would usher in new town." Sir, Jock MacDonald correctly says we agree about the need for renewable energy and is right that some find wind farms majestic and beautiful. Some love the majestic curve of a motorway slicing through boring downland outside Winchester. I am not one of them. Neither do I think it appropriate to put the largest onshore wind power stations in the south in beautiful countryside at Bullington Cross. In criticising Winchester Action on Climate Change, that's WINAC, for backing this power station, it was partly from disappointment that they are supporting foreign big business rather than local people who value our countryside for its beauty, tourist value and agriculture. I had hoped that more ambition from WINAC in encouraging a modal shift in behaviour of individuals, councils, etc. Reducing energy consumption would avoid the need for this power station. WINAC should encourage more individuals, institutions and businesses to turn down thermostats in winter and turn them up in summer to minimise energy use for heating and air conditioning. Why not lobby the county to turn off street lights and traffic lights after midnight, as other councils do? And get rid of street lights on motorways. After all, cars and lorries have had their own lights for 100 years. Other measures have collateral benefits. For instance, rolling back Winchester's noisy night economy, bars, clubs, would save energy and reduce antisocial behaviour, policing and NHS costs. Discouraging excessive time on mobile phones and the web would save energy consumption from using direct mains electricity or when charging batteries. Population growth is the main driver of the need for more power stations. Perversely, if the Bullington Cross station were built, It will be used to justify massive population growth in the form of Micheldover New Town. That's from Keith Story, St Cross Road, Winchester.
Susan Chesters writes on the Tory rebels' mock democratic process. Sir, Mr. Beadle entirely missed the point of Mr. Biden's letter in the Chronicle of June the 14th. As Conservative and Liberal Democrat activists respectively, they both support the government. Supporters of the coalition are entitled to ask how much government time Tory rebels are willing to waste on their fractious arguments. The Tory rebels not only tabled their amendment to the Queen's speech, they also published their alternative Queen's speech. They have now succeeded in tabling 40 new bills by using an arcane procedure which involved camping out in the Palace of Westminster on a camp bed for 4 nights. They undoubtedly feel strongly about their causes and have secured valuable parliamentary time in this session to discuss their measures. These include a bill renaming the August bank holiday Margaret Thatcher Day, and another entitled Prime Minister Replacement Bill, and another School Governing Bodies Adverse Weather Conditions. Now, which of these does our MP also feel so strongly about that he will vote in their support? Which of these Mr. Beadle regarded as supporting the Prime Minister? There is serious business to be done to get our economy back on track for growth and prosperity and meet the social problems of our times. The Tory rebels mock the democratic process and ignore the dangers to the economy at their peril and ours. Susan Chesters, Domham Road, Winchester.
We don't want another monstrosity, writes R.J. Webb. Sir, it has been reported that the wheels are in motion for Winchester's railway station area redevelopment to go ahead. Presumably, this will be another drawn-out fiasco like the proposed Silver Hill redevelopment, which has been dragging on for at least 10 years, and which, if it is ever built, will alter the character of the city and its skyline forever. Let us hope any redevelopments will be sympathetic to the character of the city. Then again, could either of these schemes be any worse than the hideous, badly designed, unwelcoming development that has never been fully occupied and probably never will, and which should surely itself be redeveloped? I refer, of course, to the Brooks Centre. Who on earth could ever have thought that this grotesque monstrosity would be an asset to our beautiful city? Its design looked dated before it was complete. It is an eyesore, a ghastly colour scheme, the wrong colour brickwork, and features other materials that do not blend with the city centre architecture. It is not even of sufficient merit that its presence can be forgiven. Leave the station area and Silver Hill as they are and sort this mess out first. That's from R.J. Webb, Woodman Hill, Sparsholt, Winchester.
This is a letter from Douglas Patterson. It's another letter about wind farms. Good intentions, so misunderstood. Sir, Keith Story, a co-founder of Winnac, should be congratulated for championing the countryside, Chronicle June 20th, when his colleagues are campaigning for it to be industrialised to satisfy their obsession with wind power. He is in good company. I quote this 2012 submission to a planning authority in Devon. I am James Lovelock, scientist and author, originator of the Gaia theory, a view that Earth is a self-regulating entity that keeps the surface environment always fit for life. I am an environmentalist and founder of the Greens, but I bow my head in shame at the thought that our original good intentions should have been so misunderstood and misapplied. we never intended a fundamentalist green movement that rejected all energy sources other than renewable, nor did we expect the Greens to cast aside our priceless ecological heritage because of a failure to understand that the needs of the earth are not separable from human needs. We need to take care that the spinning windmills do not become like the statues on Easter Island, monuments of a failed civilization. That's from Douglas Patterson, Chairman, Keep Hampshire Green, Hunton Grange Farm, Sutton Scotney.
Nick Ray asks, is the City Council fit for purpose? Sir, River Park Leisure Centre's replacement, Chronicle of June the 27th, consisting of a 25-metre pool, sports hall and fitness suite, sounds a lot like what we already have, and is unlikely to address current, let alone future, demand. It also feels like another example where local opinion and current needs are ignored by what feels like an undemocratic city council, not only in ignoring the argument for a super gym, pool, track at Bar End, but in its response to developments at Barton Farm, Westgate School and Abbey Mill. River Park is woefully inadequate. Despite the efforts of excellent and friendly staff and trainers, it's often impossible to book into classes which are regularly filled to capacity, yet no record of excess demand is kept. Parking is often a gamble. Bicycle security is poor. Thefts were answered, not by CCTV, but a sign saying, "Your bike might be pinched." And an extra lane pool is sorely needed. Lighting, for example, for badminton and ventilation in the main hall is terrible too. In the 12 years I've used the centre, I've never been asked for feedback or suggestions. This is along with a long and challenged commercial relationship between DC Leisure and the council, makes me seriously wonder how fit for purpose our council is. Nick Ray, Fordington Avenue, Full Flood, Winchester.
And following on from that letter is one from Sue Falconer, who is chairman of Winchester City Penguin Swimming Club. Sir, Keith Wood is right in saying Winchester City Council's, quote, primary aim is to provide facilities to people of all abilities, unquote, Chronicle June the 27th. And that is just what the clubs of Winchester are asking the council to do. Local people, almost all involved in sport and leisure of some kind, deserve adequate facilities to serve babies through to national competitors. A facility with the flexibility to do this is essential for this city and its district. It is not helpful to suggest there are two types of sports centres, one for all abilities and one for elite competitors. A community facility must provide for all. Clubs have a wide spectrum of members enjoying sport for fun, fitness and competition, but they cannot serve the community adequately with the existing facility or any replacement offering little more. A comprehensive facility like that proposed by Winchester Fit for the Future should be fully considered and funding sources explored, as we now have a rare opportunity to serve all local residents for many years to come. That letter is from Sue Falconer, Chairman, Winchester City Penguins Swimming Club.
Councillor Eileen Berry writes, something wrong with this thinking. Sir, I have been reading in the Chronicle about the proposed development at Westbourne Road Play Area. As councillor for 10 years in Week, I have been a long supporter of keeping the play area. But there is another side which has become very clear to me. There is no way that you could let young people under 10 be on their own in this very secluded area. Years ago, there was apparatus for the very young, but mothers would have to accompany their children. But with no surveillance, the apparatus got vandalised and was taken out. I sympathise with the people, tenants, who complained about antisocial behaviour. There were also a few fires lit, which caused some worry, to say the least. Not all youngsters vandalise their play area. Not all youngsters are bad, but there are a few that have caused great problems. Now, there is no doubt in my mind that if you really wanted to keep that area for youth and recreation, you'd have to throw thousands of pounds to make it safe and viable. There is another issue. If you take a green play area away and put a plan forward to close part of Froment Road to put an orchard in and an area for children to play on with one side still open and traffic going by, what does it tell you? It tells me that you should not be taking away a space to do something so ridiculous as closing one side of Froment Road to give green space. There is something wrong with that kind of thinking. Councillor Eileen Berry, Priorsdean Road, Hairstock.
Peter Stewart writes, "Invest our money in protecting jobs." Sir, so, hundreds more jobs could be axed from Hampshire County Council, as noted in the Chronicle front page of June the 27th. The council blames Whitehall cuts. Yet the government pays £53 million each day in European Union contributions. That's £19 billion annually, which rather makes a mockery of Mr. Osborne's recent savings plan. It's time we left the EU and invested taxpayers' money in protecting British jobs. Obviously, we could carry on buying European goods, but not have to pay extortionate amounts of taxpayers' money for the privilege of being governed by European politicians. Peter Stewart, Beaver Drive, Bishopstoke, East Lee.
Just to conclude the letters section, the Chronicle has this feature, Your Say. We asked, should people automatically become organ donors when they die, or should it remain a choice? Stuart Pritchard, 40, travel agent of Searles Close, Alsford, said, "I'm a donor and it is a valuable cause, but people should have the option not to do it if they do not want to. It's their body, so somebody else should not make that choice for them." Paul Williams, 54, chief executive of Winchester Area Community Action, that's WACA, of Worthy Lane Hyde, said, "There should be an opt-out where people can choose not to do it. It should be presumed that organs can be used, but not if people don't want to." Diogo Lopez, 20, student of Greenhill Road Full Flood, said, "Ultimately, someone should be able to do what they want with their own body. They should not be forced into something, even if after they die. Organ donations are a good thing, but it's not right just to take them." And Katie MacArthur, 33, housewife of Sutton Park Road, Sutton, Scotney, said, "It should not be an automatic process. I would not want my organs used after I die, and that might sound selfish, but it's my choice. Whatever happens to a person's body is up to that person." So if you'd like to have your say on this or any other topic, you can, of course, contact letters at Hampshire Chronicle, and the contact details I gave you at the beginning of the letters section. Now we have items of historical interest, and we have them from 150 and 25 years ago.
And this first one is from 100 years ago, in fact, July the 5th, 1913. Its headline is "Call for More School Birchings." Standing Committee of the Hampshire Quarter Sessions. Mr. Pember next moved the adoption of a recommendation by the visiting committee of the prison in favour of extending the age at which boys and youths may be birched. Mr. Turner seconded. He said that he had been a public schoolmaster for over 40 years, and that the thing that struck him most when he became a magistrate was the very different view taken with regard to corporal punishment by English law and by English public schools. According to English law, no boy could be birched after the age of 13. That was the age at which boys usually entered public schools. And so far as he knew, there was no public school which did not find corporal punishment sometimes necessary.
50 years ago, this is from July the 6th, 1963. Rain soaks troops at Broadlands. Under dull, leaden skies, with rain lashing down at times and at other times just drizzling, hundreds of guests with Macintosh collars turned up and umbrellas of every hue erected watched the Chief of the Defence Staff, Admiral of the Fleet, the Earl of Mountbatten of Burma, present Queen's and regimental colours to the 45th TA Battalion, the Royal Hampshire Regiment, and to the 383 Regiment Royal Artillery, Duke of Connaught's Royal Hampshire TA at Broadlands, his country home, on Saturday afternoon. The troops on parade, and there must have been some 400 in the four guard companies, must have been soaked to the skin long before the parade was half over. But they did not show it.
And 25 years ago, July the 1st, 1988, increase in fines for cockfights. The Protection of Animals Amendment Bill, sponsored by Winchester and Alton MP John Brown, has passed through the House of Lords. If the bill becomes law, the prosecution of those who organise dogfights, cockfights and badger baiting will become easier and fines will dramatically increase. "I'm very pleased about it," Mr. Brown said. He paid tribute to the, quote, "wonderful job," unquote, done by Lord Houghton, the Labour peer, who steered the bill through the upper chambers on Monday afternoon.
Next, we have the Hampshire Chronicle editorial, and that will be followed by First Person.
And the editorial comment this week is entitled, "City Centre is Best Place for Museum." The English Project and River Park Leisure Centre would appear to be strange bedfellows. Volunteers leading the project for an English language museum want to share premises with the revamped leisure centre. They say it could make River Park a major cultural and sporting landmark and provide the space they need for a museum and other exhibitions. But will highbrow museum visitors be put off by the smell of chlorine from the public swimming pool, or queues of mums with babies in buggies going to tumble tots? Clearly, there could be a culture clash. Council leader Keith Wood has said much will depend on whether the museum project has the cash to fund the scheme, and other city centre sites might be more appropriate. River Park was not a first choice for the project. Campaigners initially wanted Woolstaplers Hall, but plans fell through because of a lack of space. But what about Avalon House, the former City Council offices in Chesil Street, which have stood empty for years? It is essential this flagship project, which would draw visitors from far and wide, is in the right place, and that would be in the city centre. Ideally.
First Person this week is written by Ronald Allison, and it's headed "Rose-Tinted Memories of Summers as They Used to Be." I do so hope that last weekend wasn't it being the summer. Surely this year we're due for a lengthy spell of warm, dry weather. Several weeks would do nicely, allowing for a few short spells of rain to avoid the otherwise inevitable hosepipe ban and to keep the gardeners and farmers reasonably happy. Rain overnight would suit most of us best, I imagine. Anyway, last Sunday was so gloriously sunny in our neck of the woods that to doze off for a few minutes in the garden was to bring back those rose-tinted memories of summers as they used to be, spent on beaches or in picnics or just mucking about out of doors. Then in the evening we would have to be smothered in calamine lotion to deal with the sunburn, wonderfully soothing I can smell it even as I write. I'm sure that distance was lending enchantment to the view. Now I certainly value the benefits of sunscreen and the advice about sunbathing, but I'm equally sure our summers ain't what they used to be. If we are experiencing a change in our weather patterns, at least we are spared the excessive heat that brought the forest fires raging this week in southwestern parts of the United States. Death and destruction came with them, reminding us that while we wonder about our weather, and grumble about it too, we're not too badly off most of the time. Today, as it happens, is July the 4th, otherwise known as American Independence Day. Last month, my first person contribution came on the anniversary of D-Day. Then we and the Americans fought side by side. Back in 1776, the American colonies rejoiced in winning their freedom from Great Britain. 200 years later, in 1976, the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh were in the States to celebrate the bicentennial. Gerald Ford was the president, the first man to hold the office without being elected even as vice president. The differences between the two constitutional processes were vividly seen. A hereditary monarch and a politician who would be voted out of office later that year. Yet, and still today, we have so much in common. Incidentally, at the time of the bicentennial visit, Barack Obama was not yet 15. I wonder if at that age he was thinking of politics as his career, or if he ever had the wildest dream of moving into the White House. And if he ever voiced such an ambition, did anyone say to him, "Why not?" He, of all people, had the right to use the slogan, "Yes, we can." Meanwhile, we await the birth of the boy or girl who will become the third in line of succession to the throne. He or she will certainly have great, great grandparents.
Many of you will know or remember that on the 10th of June was the annual general meeting and garden party of Winchester Talking Newspaper. And we had a special guest there, the speaker, a young man called Adam Knott, who was a Paralympian in last year's Paralympic Games. And he came along to talk about his experiences of why he is a Paralympian and what he does in his life to do with the goalball team. Rachel Masker, who is one of the feature writers on the Hampshire Chronicle, came along to both the AGM and the garden party and interviewed Adam Knott and his family, and has written this feature, which we have decided to read in full. Achieving their goals thanks to Team Knott, and that's K-N-O-T-T, their surname. Rachel Masker meets Bridget Knott from Chandler's Ford and her two partially sighted Paralympian sons, who have defied the odds to achieve both sporting and academic success. Bridget Knott doesn't just make meals for her two strapping sons, she cooks for the whole British goalball team too. Her family home in Chandler's Ford, where she lives with her husband Phil and sons Adam, 18, and David, 16, who are team members, is the unofficial camp for the GB squad. Mr. and Mrs. Knott regularly look after the men's team, who travel across the country to train at Peter Simmons College in Winchester. "During regular training sessions, we feed 10, says Mrs. Knott, 47, a part-time florist who works in Shirley, Southampton. Goalball is a team sport specifically for blind athletes. Players compete in two teams of three and try to throw a ball, travelling at speeds of up to 60 miles an hour, into the opponent's goal whilst keeping it out of their own net. The ball is bigger and heavier than a basketball and has bells inside. Players use their hearing to judge the position of the ball. Blindfolds mean that partially sighted players can compete on an equal footing with blind players. Mrs. Knott says, "All the squad call me their goalball mum, and one player just calls me mum, which makes me laugh because he's 42. They love lasagna and a pasta dish I make with a beef brisket. They are very complimentary about my cooking. The team manager said I should write a cookbook. They even gave it a name, Hollow Legs, because they do eat a lot. Mattresses on the floors of the four-bedroom house provide somewhere to sleep, and Mrs. Knott said the squad became like one big family in the run-up to London 2012. Those that get a bed count themselves lucky. Otherwise, she says, it's a mattress on the floor. Only the coach gets his own room. Mr. Knott helps by driving the squad to and from training sessions and picking up players from the railway station. Why didn't they stay in a hotel? Well, says Mrs. Knott, there was so little funding, it was a means of getting to the games. It keeps costs down, which means more training sessions. It's also more relaxed. They can come back here after training and just chill. Mrs. Knott added, generally speaking, something gets left behind, like a pair of socks or T-shirt, because the team members can't see to pack, although they do their best. Goalball has been a Paralympic sport since 1976, but London 2012 was the first year Britain entered a men's team. The Knott brothers found their faces on playing cards and shiny stickers. At 6 foot 5 inches, Adam towers over his 5 foot 6 inch mum. The Peter Simmons student, who has just taken A-levels in music, maths and Spanish, has only 10% vision. It was a complete surprise, says Mrs. Knott, when Adam was born with albinism. Both she and her husband carried the recessive gene and had a 1 in 4 chance of passing the condition to their children. 2 years later, the couple had another son, David, who also has albinism and is partially sighted. Albinism is a rare hereditary condition resulting in little or no pigment in the skin, hair and eyes. It can also mean vision problems. When Adam was little, his dad feared he would not be able to play many of the sports he had enjoyed. But both boys have exceeded all expectations by doing that and much more. Mrs. Knott said, "My husband is absolutely thrilled because he never got to represent his country. His doubts when they were young have been proved completely wrong." Both boys have attended regular schools. Mrs. Knott praised Thorndon School in Chandler's Ford and Peter Simmons for supporting her sons. Adam achieved 11 GCSEs at all grades A or A star and teaches piano and flute after reaching grade 8. Now he has started a Winchester Goalball Club, training players who meet every other Saturday at Peter Simmons. David, the younger brother, who is 6 feet, has just taken his GCSEs at Thorndon School. He is also musical, has grade 8 in tenor horn, and together with his mum is assistant coach for the new club. The Knotts have always encouraged their sons to try different sports, keep active, and not to let their disabilities stop them. The brothers have played rugby, golf, cricket, football, table tennis, and even gone scuba diving. Some things worked, said Mrs. Knott, some didn't. Once they started doing disability sports, it became apparent they are both very good sportsmen. Since the games, the GB goalball team has continued to compete at home and abroad. The squad is soon to play in Sheffield and Poland. Mrs. Knott said, "I travelled with the team for a couple of tournaments leading up to the games because I wanted to share the experience, but on the whole, I don't travel with them. I think sometimes it's important my boys are there without their mum hanging on. But she's stocking up her food cupboard for the next summer training session. It's a bit like Christmas," she says. "It takes a lot of time and preparation, and I love it when the players are here, but I'm quite glad to get the house back as well." And there's a little footnote to this article which tells us that Winchester Goalball Club is on the lookout for new members. And for those of you who can access it, you can email winchestergoalball at yahoo.com. That's Winchester Goalball, all one word, at yahoo.com.
Right, well, continuing with the rest of the news, the first item here is winning the battle against superbugs. Hospital-acquired infections falling, says Trust. Three Hampshire hospitals are winning the battle against potentially fatal superbugs, the latest figures show. Rates for MRSA and Clostridium difficile, C. diff, infections continue to fall at Winchester's Royal Hampshire County Hospital, Andover War Memorial Hospital and Basingstoke Hospital. Between April 2012 and March 2013, Hampshire Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust, which runs the three hospitals, recorded 40 cases of C. diff, which was down on 55 the previous year. Its target is to halve that figure next year. There's been a dramatic fall in hospital-acquired infections over the past 5 years. In 2007, at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital alone, there were 158 patients with C. diff, an infection of the gut which can lead to severe diarrhoea and bowel inflammation. Figures also show the Trust recorded one case of MRSA in 2013 compared to 18 in 2003-04. Dr. Matthew Dryden, consultant microbiologist, said a simple way to stop the spread of superbugs was better hygiene. A high-profile Clean Your Hands campaign encouraged doctors and nurses to wash their hands between patients. Speaking at a health focus event at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital, Dr. Dryden said bugs could also be spread by doctors' stethoscopes and pens, which should be wiped down with alcohol rubs. Dr. Dryden said, if a doctor plants a stethoscope on the chest of a patient who happens to have MRSA and then onto another, it may transfer the superbug. Overcrowding on hospital wards could also lead to the spread of superbugs. Dr. Dryden said he would like every patient to have their own room and ensuite facilities to reduce the risk of infection. But, he said, some senior hospital managers believe patients prefer to stay on wards so they can chat to others. Dr. Dryden said the Trust had become better at deep cleaning wards to control the spread of superbugs. He warned the E. coli was the next big problem, the next MRSA coming from abroad and in food, increasingly resistant to common antibiotics.
Watercress line in £100,000 appeal. One of Hampshire's biggest attractions has launched a £100,000 appeal to fund urgent repairs. The watercress line, which runs heritage steam engines from Alsford to Alton, needs the cash to prevent Boyne's Wood Bridge from potentially collapsing. Flaws in the brickwork were reported at Christmas time, and a subsequent survey revealed that the bridge at Four Marks near Alsford would pose a serious safety risk if left unchecked. The appeal by Midhants Railway, which operates the line, said the repairs will be carried out immediately to prevent serious deterioration, with a consequent risk to safety and the threat to running trains between Medstead and Four Marks. Obviously, it is unthinkable that we do not run through to Alton, but the railway does not have £100,000 lying around. And so we are making an appeal to all members to, yet again, dig deep into pockets to support our railway at this time. East Hampshire District Ward member Pat Seward said it would be a shame to see the Watercress line stop at Four Marks. Councillor Seward said, I know the bridge needs repair, but I didn't know about the appeal. The Watercress line is a good tourist attraction and it brings people in from miles around. It would be a pity if the line couldn't carry on to Alton. I wish them well in their appeal, but there are other issues in the village that are far more important, like keeping the village pub. It comes as the iconic footbridge at King's Cross Station, used in the Harry Potter films, was added to the line earlier this year. The Grade 1 listed structure was dismantled and removed from the London station as part of major refurbishment in 2008 and has been reopened as a vantage point at Ropley Station. To donate, send cheques made payable to the Midhants Railway Preservation Society. Midhants Railway, the railway station, Alsford, SO249DG, marking the envelope with Bridge.
Enter Dragon Boat Race. Team spirit is essential. Experience of dragon boats is not. Winchester Samaritans are appealing for all comers for this year's Dragon Boat Race and say there are plenty of prizes up for grabs. The day's racing will see teams compete in 40-foot narrow boats decorated with a Chinese dragon head and tail and propelled by 16 paddlers kept in rhythm by a drummer. A dragon boat specialist will steer each boat, so no previous experience is needed, and every team is given full safety instructions with all equipment provided. For more details and to enter, call 07702 430 243. That's 07702 430 243. The race takes place on Sunday, July the 14th at the Itchin Navigation in Garnier Road, St Cross.
Station area revamp takes the next step. The wheels are beginning to turn on the next big development in Winchester. The City Council is about to commission an architect to look at how the area around the railway station could be developed. The station approach area includes the station, car parks, Carfax site, Andover Road to the railway bridge and the cattle market area. The assessment will look at the potential for the location, aiming to maximise the economic benefits for the city. It will look to maximise walking and cycling. A report to the Council Cabinet is scheduled for October. Local architects Paul Bulkley and David Ash say there is potential to attract national companies to the site their headquarters in Winchester in a similar way to Basingstoke. The City Council is working closely with Network Rail, the County Council and other partners and will consult local stakeholders as part of the process. Keith Wood, leader of the City Council, said there is a great potential to improve the area around the railway station in a way that dramatically enhances one of the most important entrances to Winchester, while also boosting the city's economy. Councillor Wood added, "Our assessment of the development potential for the Andover Road area will show us what options are available and inform our decisions in the coming months." There is support for the master plan from local civic groups such as City of Winchester Trust. Mr Ash, Director of CH Design Partnership, said he welcomed the fact that the council was considering a wide area and not just around the station, with an emphasis on high-quality public spaces and car parking.
New mum died of rare heart condition. A Winchester mother died from a rare heart condition just 8 days after giving birth to triplets, an inquest heard. Moments before she collapsed at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital, Isabel Mason had been talking about needing a bigger car and a buggy for her 3 newborn babies. Doctors and midwives battled to resuscitate the first-time mother, but were unable to save her. She suffered a cardiac arrest and died on March the 10th, 2012. Mrs. Mason had remained in hospital where her premature babies, Matthias, Lucas and Sarah, were being looked after in the special care baby unit. Mrs. Mason, aged 34, died from hemopericardium, where blood leaks into a sac surrounding the heart from a tear in the artery. Medical staff told the inquest in Winchester the only treatment would have been emergency surgery if it had been spotted earlier. But there was no evidence she had a heart problem. Consultant pathologist Dr. Samantha Holden told the condition would have been triggered by pregnancy or by Marfan's syndrome, an inherited condition that can cause heart defects. The inquest heard that Mrs. Mason showed some of the traits of Marfan's, but a test proved inconclusive. Mrs. Mason and her husband Paul lived in Tegdown Meads, Wick. The couple both worked for Ordnance Survey in Southampton. As they planned for a family, Mrs. Mason, an IT project manager from Germany, had fertility treatment. She was admitted to the Royal Hampshire County Hospital after a pregnancy of 34 weeks and gave birth by caesarean section to 3 healthy babies. Consultant obstetrician and gynaecologist Martin Pittman said, as is often the case with parents who struggle to conceive, it was a joyous event. Mrs. Mason was kept in hospital, as she had suffered from preeclampsia and anemia, which left her weak, dizzy, and short of breath. The inquest heard she complained of feeling unwell as the anaesthetist, Dr. Nicola Boswelly, prepared to give out a blood transfusion, and she slumped onto the bed. Midwife June Phillips said, one minute Mrs. Mason was talking about the baby's buggy and how she needed a bigger car, the next minute she passed out. Coroner Mr. Short said, this was a tragedy for Mr. Mason and Isabel's parents, but most of all, for the 3 children. Recording a narrative verdict, Mr. Short said Mrs. Mason died from natural causes. In a statement afterwards, Mr. Mason paid tribute to his wife and said the family had been devastated by her sudden death. He said, we feel extremely sad to lose Isabel. She has left a huge gap in our lives. However, we all have such happy memories of an inspiring, beautiful, and much-loved person who achieved so much, including motherhood, in a life tragically cut short.
Still pulling in the punters, 40 years on. With as many as 26 pubs closing in Britain every week, it seems one Winchester watering hole has found the recipe for success. Publicans Mike and Lynn Sinker celebrated 40 years in charge at the Baker's Arms in the city with a party last Thursday. Mr. Sinker, 70, said he was delighted to reach the milestone and had enjoyed every minute of his time there. There has never been a day when I didn't want to get up and do the business, he said. I have loved being a part of Winchester, especially these days now we have the High Street Market right on our doorstep and there's more of a city feel to the place. The pair said they have so many fond memories over 4 decades, it's hard to choose a favourite. But one not so fond recollection was the time 20 years ago when Mr. Sinker got a phone call while on holiday in Spain from future Winchester Mayor Chris Pines, telling him the pub was on fire. Mrs. Sinker, 65, added, I always remember when we had a parrot who used to sit on Mike's shoulder when he worked behind the bar, and if anyone came near him, the bird would go for them. We had another customer who used to bring in a 10-foot python, which used to scare the customers. Councillor Ernie Jeffs, the current mayor, said, it's fantastic they've been here for so long. They are running it the right way, especially in these days with so many pubs closing. A lot of people are running pubs purely looking for profit, but this one has friendly staff and people really enjoy it. Councillor Pines, who has been a regular customer throughout the Sinker's tenure, added, it's a local pub, and it's really nice to have a landlord and landlady who get involved in the community. The party continued over the weekend with a quiz, sponsored head shave, and a family fun day, all in aid of Macmillan Cancer Support. And this article is accompanied by a photograph of Mike and Lynn Sinker with Winchester Mayor Councillor Ernie Jeffs, all holding up drinks towards the camera. I wouldn't say that they're necessarily the first ones. The drinks, that is.
Elderly to benefit from pilot scheme. City Council to expand support services. Winchester Civic Chiefs are launching a pilot scheme for elderly people to avoid losing a contract with the County Council. The City Council currently has an arrangement with the County to provide support services to all of the elderly in the Winchester district. But housing officers said that county chiefs were flexing their muscles and threatening to cancel the contract because the City Council is only providing the service to its sheltered housing tenants. The £321,000 a year contract only provides support for up to 850 clients, or 425 hours per week. And city housing officers admit they are not taking referrals from county colleagues. Head of Landlord Services at the City Council, Richard Botham, said, "We have to hold our hands up. We have not been meeting the obligations of our contract. The county has approached us before saying, we have someone we want you to support, and we have not been able to." He was speaking at a housing committee that approved a new floating support service that will see teams of support workers based in hubs around the district able to provide home visits. It means no more site-specific support workers at council-sheltered housing areas. Tenants currently pay a compulsory weekly £13 charge for support at such schemes, but officers confirmed they would now be able to opt out if they did not need the service. Monica Gill of Winchester Tenants and Council Together, TACT, said residents were satisfied with the changes. She said, "We are hoping to arrange informal meetings at sheltered housing schemes to have a cup of tea and talk about it, but most of the comments we have heard are that residents are happy to go along with it. The people who are most pleased are the ones paying the charge, who don't need it to, and now they can opt out. The elderly support contract is set to expire in March 2015.
Game for anything, that's BBC frontman Mike. He's a Winchester man whose face is beamed out to millions of viewers every week. The BBC's Mike Bushell, who got his first break in journalism with the Hampshire Chronicle back in the late 1980s, has become familiar to the public over the past 7 years as he tries his hand at some of the most obscure and sometimes dangerous sports in the UK. Now a new book brings together all Bushell's best bits, compiled from 350 different sports. Readers are invited to hop off the sofa and join him as he swaps his suit for shorts, showcasing the thrills and spills of the world's craziest alternative sports. Educated at King Alfred's College, he still lives in the district, and in between shin kicking, elephant polo, worm charming, and swamp soccer, you'll find him at home in Whitchurch. 7 years ago, I was on an autumn walk through a forest on the Hampshire-Berkshire border when I was nearly run over by a pack of husky dogs pulling a sled. There wasn't a speck of snow in sight. I'd stumbled into a different world, the National League of Dog Sled Husky Racing. I started thinking, if this is out there, what other sports activities are that we don't know about, he said. But Mr. Bushell said he hasn't always been such a fan of sports. I got the running bug again, went back living in Whitchurch, and a Scotsman who called himself a hare moved to the area and introduced me to the world of hashing, which is huge in Winchester and the area. It's basically drinkers who, having a running problem, a social running club which involves running along a trail set by a human hare, but with false trails designed to get you lost, he said. Famed for trying out a dazzling array of extreme sports as part of his weekend sport bulletin, perhaps nobody is better placed to explain how, when, and where, and why you might consider joining the ranks of some dedicated practitioners of the wildest sports on the planet.
Alarming rise in abandoned animals. 300 dumped in just 2 months. says RSPCA. And at the beginning of this article is a photograph of four of the sweetest little kittens you'll ever see, who were recently found abandoned in Hursley. These cute kittens are just some of the innocent casualties of a shocking rise in the number of abandoned animals. The RSPCA has revealed that the number of animals dumped in Hampshire during the past 2 months has topped 300 and is more than double the numbers for the previous year. Recent cases include the four kittens abandoned to fend for themselves near Winchester and a tethered horse found collapsed in a field in West End. The animal rescue charity told how the number of animals abandoned in Hampshire between May and June last year was 127, compared to 327 animals for the same period this year. This reflects an alarming increase the RSPCA has seen across the country, including an increasing number left in unusual or out-of-the-way places. It is urging residents to be vigilant and to alert it if they notice boxes, bins or bags that could contain abandoned animals, and to look out for movement and noises. RSPCA Deputy Chief Inspector Ben Strangwood said some people were literally treating their pets like rubbish. He says, "It's bad enough when we find a box of kittens wrapped in blankets on our doorstep with a note. But now people are deliberately dumping their animals in out-of-the-way places like bins, skips or on waste ground and leaving them to die."
Royal Hampshire County Hospital to lead Lyme disease research. Hospital to host National Clinic to treat infections. Winchester's Royal Hampshire County Hospital is to host the first National Centre for Lyme Disease, a vicious infection that can attack the nervous system. Dr. Matthew Dryden, consultant microbiologist at Romsey Road Hospital, will lead the National Lyme Disease Clinic with sessions starting in September. While the Health Protection Agency reports fewer than 2,000 cases of Lyme disease per year in the UK, the number is on the rise and Hampshire's a hot spot. Dr. Dryden is a leading authority on the disease, which is spread by tick bites. He has seen 508 confirmed cases over his 20-year career at the RHCH. He said, "We do get to see quite a lot of patients here, but we don't have a proper clinic. It will be the first National Lyme Disease Referral Service." Dr. Dryden believes the increase may be down to more people living in wooded areas, including Chandler's Ford and the New Forest. "The first symptom is a red circular skin rash which may subside after a week or two. A high temperature, muscle and joint pain may then follow. Most infections are not serious, but in extreme cases it can cause paralysis, encephalitis and meningitis. It's caused by the bacteria Borrelia burgdorferi, found in the digestive system of deer, pheasants and mice. When a tick bites an animal carrying this bacteria, they can become infected with it. The tick can then transfer the bacteria by biting humans." Dr. Dryden was one of the most dramatic cases, reported in The Lancet, involved a man in his 40s with a creeping numbness in both hands who felt lethargic and uncharacteristically depressed. An MRI scan showed a large tumour on his spine, which neurosurgeons said was inoperable. It then emerged that he had been bitten by an insect on a camping trip. A blood test proved positive for Lyme disease. After 3 months of treatment with antibiotics, the tumour disappeared, along with his symptoms. Dr. Dryden plans to work 2 days a week at the Porton Down in Wiltshire to direct national laboratory work funded by Public Health England and run weekly clinics at the RHCH. Aims include better diagnosis of patients, researching the causes of the tick-borne infection and the best treatment. The disease was named after Lyme in Connecticut, USA, where it first became widely known. Simple precautions include wearing long-sleeved shirts and trousers when walking in tick-infested areas.
Junction set for safety works. A Winchester accident black spot is set for major changes to improve safety. Hampshire Civic Chiefs met on Monday to discuss the junction of the A33 with London Road in Kingsworthy. They unanimously agreed to pursue plans to reduce vehicle speed and improve pedestrian and cyclist provision. Attending the meeting were MP Steve Bryan, Chief Inspector Darius Hammett-Poor of Hampshire Police, City Council Leader Keith Wood, County Ward Member Jackie Porter, Ian Gordon of Kingsworthy Parish Council, Penny Fleemans of Itchen Valley Parish Council, Alison Matthews and Richard Coleman of the Upper Itchen Valley Society, and Martin Wiltshire of the County Highways team. County officers confirmed the junction was also earmarked in its casualty reduction scheme for 2014-15 and also agreed to conduct a speed test on cars approaching the junction from both directions. Speaking after the meeting, Mr. Bryan said, "The message is clear. We want significant changes to the junction to slow everything down and protect driver, cyclist and pedestrian safety for the long term. None of us are highway specialists, which is why we are requesting very clear and costed plans from the County Council which match our ambition for the site and provide something we can ultimately work towards delivering." The county has already set aside £30,000 for minor improvements at the junction, but the meeting agreed they were not sufficient. Mr. Bryan added, "It was unanimously agreed that this was seriously lacking in ambition and would make little, if any, difference to the dangers faced by drivers negotiating the junction if proceeded with in isolation." Local County Councillor Jackie Porter said, "The meeting was useful, and it's great to hear everyone is now getting behind the long campaign to improve the safety of the junction. Villages on both sides of the A33 have been keen to see something done here for years. Although very frightening for all involved, the two recent accidents needing full emergency cover may lead to more improvements here than were already planned." Councillor Porter added, "We are all keen that it shouldn't be a sticking plaster solution. Residents deserve more than that."
Football club's big plans for future. Winchester City Community Football Club is hoping for a major revamp of its ground. The club is in discussions with the City Council over a £1.5 million project to install an AstroTurf pitch, a two-thirds size training pitch, improve the clubhouse and build a new 500-seat stand at the Den Plan City Ground in Abbots Barton. David Malone, Director of Football, said, "At this stage, the Council is seriously considering this proposal with a view to funding, or part funding the development and then leasing the ground to us. We have a lot of local support, including Winchester City Flyers and the Rugby Club, and the Council has been very supportive so far. There's a long way to go, and we have to go through a lot of hoops to make it happen, but it's the only way to truly make it a community facility. A 4G pitch meets FA standards for the club to play matches, but could also be hired out for community use." Mr. Malone said, "These 4G pitches can generate a significant amount of income, and it will become self-funding before you know it. Council funding would be an investment, and we would expect to pay a return on whatever that investment was." He added the clubhouse would be available to Abbots Barton residents to hold meetings and events, whilst a purpose-built nursery would also be provided. Councillor Dominic Hiscock, ward member, said, "We are trying to improve community provision in Abbots Barton, so it makes sense because it meets a need and the opportunity is there. but there's an awful lot of talking still to do, and we have to know what is possible and where the money is coming from. Council leader Keith Wood said, "Our first priority is to keep the club going, and we are doing that by giving them a one-year lease. Looking further ahead, one of our conditions was that Winchester be a community club and not just a Saturday afternoon thing. If we can get that started, it opens up other possibilities for improving the ground."
Ancient bones yield clues about leprosy. Medieval skeletons unearthed in Winchester at the site of one of Britain's oldest hospitals have given new clues to the roots of leprosy in Europe. Archaeologists at the University of Winchester, who are carrying out a dig in the former leper hospital at St Mary Magdalene, have contributed to a piece of research on the genetic origins of the disease. The study links the sudden spread of leprosy to the Crusades and popularity of pilgrimage, especially to the Holy Land. It involved DNA analysis of 5 medieval leprosy cases in Winchester, Denmark and Sweden. The results showed the presence of genetic markers now common in the Middle East. The study, published in Science magazine, also looked at genetic comparisons of medieval and modern Mycobacterium lepra, the bacterium which causes the disease. University archaeologists Dr. Simon Rofi and Dr. Katie Tucker helped to write the research and supplied UK skeletons for the study. Dr. Rofi said, "I believe St Mary Magdalene is home to one of Britain's earliest known hospitals, founded in the mid to late 11th century, and that it was a pioneering hospital in created as a response to the sudden spread of leprosy in England." This idea is further supported by the genome research that has revealed the disease spread during the time of the Crusades. I think it might also be linked to the popularity of pilgrimage, especially to the Holy Land during this period. The dig hit the headlines in 2010 after radiocarbon analysis provided a date range of AD 960 to 1030 for a series of burials, most showing signs of leprosy at the site. Most historians and archaeologists had believed hospitals in Britain only dated from after the Norman Conquest of 1066. Dr. Rofi said, "Our work has focused on the building's burial and artefacts with the aim of studying the history and development of the former medieval leprosy hospital. Now our work is feeding into the scientific origins of leprosy, and as a result we are finding out more about the disease. The university has been conducting a dig on the site since 2007, led by Dr. Rofi and Dr. Phil Marta. The site is used to train students in excavation." And there is a photograph here of Dr. Simon Rofi imposed on a photograph of a medieval skeleton partially dug up. And the skeleton, the skull features a fine set of teeth, and the skeleton seems to be smiling at the prospect of being dug up after all these years.
Sculptor adding finishing touches to viaduct restoration. A Hampshire sculptor is working to put the finishing touches to the restoration of the Hockley Viaduct. Nicola Henshaw, who lives and works in the New Forest, will produce an interpretation scheme for the Victorian structure that carried the Southampton to Newbury Railway until the 1960s. Working in wood, she will create a series of distinctive panels, benches and way markers. For inspiration, she has been visiting local schools and sheltered housing. Organisations ranging from the Friends of Hockley Viaduct to Compton All Saints Primary School in Highcliffe, close to where the railway line ran, met at the viaduct recently. They collected items from around the viaduct to be made into themed story bags. The story bags will go to sheltered housing schemes where residents will be asked to help dream up stories based on the objects inside. The stories will also go to All Saints School and be transformed by the children into shadow puppet performances with Nicola's help. Those shapes will form the templates for carvings that will appear on the way markers, panels and benches. The scheme is funded by Hampshire County Council, the Friends of Hockley Viaduct and the Environment Agency. The City Council has led the commissioning.
Council Homes Expansion Plan. Winchester Civic Chiefs have approved a £400,000 programme to expand council homes. It is part of a plan to help families living in overcrowded conditions by creating new rooms through loft conversions and side extensions. A housing review identified 40 homes which lacked bedroom space, of which 15 qualify for extensions, although only 3 are suitable for loft conversions. Speaking at a housing committee last month, Head of Landlord Services, Richard Botham, said it was a positive resolution for people in need. Councillors praised the programme and said it was a sensible solution. Housing portfolio holder Councillor Tony Coates said, "If we take these 15 off the waiting list, it means others will have fewer people to compete with." The programme will extend over 2 years, with £200,000 budgeted per year. But the committee also introduced a cap on the cost of a single conversion, limiting it to £30,000.
Survey will help decide pub site's fate. A survey at a Winchester pub site over the next few weeks will clarify its potential uses. The City Council will survey the new Queen's Head in Stanmore, including trees and on adjoining land at Stanmore Recreation Ground. The Council bought the pub earlier this year for potential community use, including relocating the Carroll Centre. The City Council launched plans to revamp the Stanmore Estate earlier this year. The ideas included developing the recreation space and knocking down houses for redevelopment and building on allotments and garages. Some suggestions have been highly unpopular. Keith Wood, council leader, said, "Work is on track to bring a final version of the Stanmore planning framework to Cabinet for a decision in the autumn, including feedback from the public consultation. In the meantime, we will look at the new Queen's Head pub site to see what options it provides. We want to make best use of this asset for the good of the community in Stanmore as soon as we can." Councillor Wood added, "The survey will help us to understand what is practical and possible."
More cash to rid potholes. Extra funding and resources have been pledged to prioritise the eradication of potholes. Hampshire County Council has promised to carry on doing all it can to respond to the higher-than-normal number of reports of potholes and other road defects it has had this year due to the bad weather. Sean Woodward, Executive Member for Economy, Transport and Environment, said, "We know that the condition of Hampshire's roads is a concern for residents and businesses, and the leader of the council has ensured that tackling potholes remains a top priority. We've been putting in more money, more manpower, and making the most of specialist equipment in order to restore our roads. This approach has already having a positive impact in the worst affected areas, which we have been specifically targeting, with reports of defects beginning to fall from the high levels at the beginning of the year. During March, an extra £170,000 was redirected to respond to reports of road defects, while funding in this year's highways budget has also been reprioritised to support works to restore the roads. This, combined with specific funding from central government, means an additional investment of around £3 million. The County Council's highways maintenance contractor, Amy, has increased the number of gangs working to fix the roads and additional mobile hot boxes that carry hot material for permanent pothole repairs are being used along with two jet patchers. Resources are being focused on safety defects and being targeted in the worst affected areas, including enlisting reinforcements by trialling the multi-hog in Andover and Romsey areas and the New Forest. The multi-hog gives highways maintenance crews the ability to repair 200 square metres of road in just 2 hours, as it can plane out, fill and finish a road surface as it travels. Operation Resilience, which has a budget of £22 million during 2013 and 14, is continuing.
That concludes our extracts for the week. Our thanks to our editors, Jean Carswell, Ken Clemenson and Barbara Chase, and to our various technical teams. And thanks to our readers, Margot Meredith.
Goodbye.
John Richards.
Goodbye.
And Peter Lydiard.
Goodbye.
And from me, John Parker, goodbye too, and have a good week. Please return the memory stick as soon as you're able, not forgetting to put your address label inside the envelope.